Anyway, my name is Carol and I'm an alcoholic. So, yeah, okay. I was born in Calgary, and some of you may not know where that is, but it's here's a clue to what growing up might have been. It's they're always bragging about the fact that it's home to the world's largest rodeo. And so, yeah, a lot of rednecks is the point I'm making. And my family wasn't from there. My family was, my mom and dad were from Toronto. And, you know, in the 60s, there was one of those times where, I don't know, you know, in Canada, you see this large exodus of people going from the east to the west following the economy and the boom and bust cycle in Calgary, because another thing it's known for is oil. It's an oil rich, well, it was oil rich. They've pretty much sucked most of it out of the ground. But anyways, my parents were both running. I'm taking a degree in psychology. So I recently did I call it a genogram. So it's like it's like your family tree, but from a psychological point of view. So yeah, they were both definitely on the run from their families. And you know, my ancestors are Irish, and there was a lot of trauma in on my dad's side of the family. We had my grandmother lost four brothers over 10 years, and they were all traumatized from leaving Ireland and all the things that happened to them on the way and when they got here. And so there was a addiction, unbelievable addiction. They were all addicted. They all died in strange accidents. One shot himself by accident hunting. One, I don't know, the church record said committed suicide in an insane fit. Anyways, when I recently did this genogram, I realized, wow, you know, I have my own trauma in my life, but I came into the world with my ancestors' trauma. And I never saw that before. It was fascinating to me. And I have a lot of forgiveness for my parents, but it helped me forgive them even more. But my father, he had all of that, and he had a drinking problem, and he tried to quit drinking and couldn't. And when I was six, my father committed suicide. And I remember the phone ringing that night, and I remember getting a cold chill. And I don't know how I knew at the age of six to numb myself, but I did. I got the cold chill, and I knew somehow that my father had died. And by the next morning, I had blocked that out emotionally. Anyway, we have a little brother, Michael, and my older sister, Leslie. And so here we are in this redneck town, and my mom is now a single mother in a redneck town in the early 70s. So good luck. And my father's side of the family was very wealthy. So that, you know, kudos to my ancestors for that. My great great grandfather came here with nothing and built up a massive fortune. There's still buildings in Toronto that he helped build, helped mortgage. He was incredible. So anyways, they had a lot of money. And so, but my mom's side of the family, they didn't have very much money. And so, you know, the rich side of the family comes in and buys us a house. And so now we're a single mom family. My mom's a waitress, which she started that because when my dad was drinking, she got a job in a lounge. And you know, but we're living in this very wealthy community with a bunch of snobs. I don't know if you've met people that have the snob and redneck thing in one, but they're not nice people. But anyways, so the rest of my childhood and adolescence was awful. And I just never fit there. I remember my mom telling me for weeks, getting so excited, we're going to the rodeo, and everyone knew that I loved animals. So they're like, Carol's gonna love this, you know? And And we're sitting in the rodeo, and the first thing that happens, the guy's out of the gate, and he lassos a little calf, a little baby calf, and he starts like torturing it. And I'm just like in tears. I'm the only one at the rodeo, and just bawling my eyes out. How can they do this to this poor animal? And you know, my family's reaction is, oh, she's so emotional. And that's the way my whole childhood and adolescent went, and horrible things happened. Horrible things. My mother dated horrible men. She had no idea of safety, and she wanted a husband, because the only way to sort of become legitimate again in this crazy community that we lived in was to get a husband. So I've been through every kind of abuse you can imagine. Yeah. The worst, I think, is when I was 13, one of her boyfriends would force me into human trafficking. And that's when I started drinking. When I start drinking by choice, it was forced on me. And anyways, when he finally left, my mom kicked him out. But my family didn't really know what was happening with me. My mom would be at work, and I would, you know, he just dragged me out of the house in the middle of the night. And my family didn't know. Anyways, my mom kicked him out for other reasons. After that, I was so traumatized and so addicted to alcohol and drugs that I just continued on. And I tried to get through high school, but I just kept, you know, I remember being told, well, you've missed 30 classes in each thing that you're taking, so you know, we have to kick you out, or I drop out, whatever. And when I was 18, my sister had met somebody in Toronto, a guy, and she wanted to come live in Toronto, and she asked me if I wanted to go with her. And at first I thought that was a stupid idea, because I didn't want to leave all my great life. And over a few days, I realized if I don't get the fuck out of here, I'll probably never have a life. So I came to Toronto with her. And that was an interesting year. I was 18 and I had never tried to limit my drinking. So, you know, now I'm living on my own with my sister. I had to get a job. I had to pay bills and stuff. And so I started to try to only have 2 glasses of wine. And that only worked once. And to this day, it's still one of the worst nights of my life. Because all I think about, I sat there after having those 2 drinks, feeling like I want another one, and just fighting that all night long. So then I went out one night with a friend after a year of this trying to control my drinking. And I was just a horrible person that night. They dragged me out of the bar before last call because they knew what I was like and they didn't want to deal with it. And so because they dragged me out, I was, this was a guy that I was dating, and he was driving on a busy road, and I kept trying to steer the, you know, push the steering wheel so that he would drive into oncoming traffic. So he kicked me out of the car. And the next day when I woke up, I think that's maybe the first time I ever felt like I always felt like there was something wrong with me. But I was scared of my drinking for the first time, like really scared. And so my sister said something to me. My friend that I've been out with that night said to me, "You are a really wonderful person until you drink." So I went out on the balcony. We lived in a high rise, and I went out on the balcony, and I was thinking I should jump. And I don't know, a voice said to me, everyone in AA thought it was God. I don't think it was God. I think it was my father speaking to me. That a voice told me to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I never really, I don't think I'd ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I called, and this great lady named Iris told me she'd be around that night. This was in the 80s when AA was like so grassroots. It was fabulous. She just came on over, and she did that for the next 3 months. She came and picked me up all the time, took me to meetings. She sat in the car with me for hours, just talking. And I relapsed once, and then that was it. I got sober. And that was actually out in Mississauga, a little suburb outside Toronto. And then I decided to go back to school. So I moved in with my grandma on my mom's side. She was living here in Toronto. And I went back to school and joined a group in Toronto called the Hill Group. And it was a fabulous group. They were nice people. I had no idea. I had this education that I was going back to school, but I got into a university. And if, as long as I did okay the first year, then I would get all of my high school updated and I could go on and take whatever I wanted in university. And I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know how to write an essay. I didn't know how to do shit. And the Hill Group is still to this day known as, they call it the Hollywood of AA in Toronto. But they were smart people. There was a journalist there. And I ended up eventually going into journalism. His name was Ray. And he would sit with me and tell me how to talk to my professors, tell me of the things I would have to know. These people really helped me. So I my dream when I came to Toronto, my dream from the time I was a little girl, one of them was to be a writer. And so I had this English professor, very nice man. He was a really well-known Canadian author named Eric Wright. And he knew that I wanted an A in his class, and he gave me a B++. And so, and these people at the Hill Group, whenever something like that would happen, they'd say, well, you got to go talk to him. You got to go ask him why. And I'd be like, no, I don't want to talk to him. They'd be like, nope, you got to go. So I went to see him, and I said, B++, that's an A. What are you doing? He said, well, you see, I'm a writer, and I don't meet very many good writers. And then he read me a couple of sentences from an essay that I had done. And he said, see, that's really good writing. You don't see that very often. He said, the problem with you is that you have this gift and you're not applying yourself as much as you could. It's a waste. So until you apply yourself, and you know, when you grab a word out of the thesaurus, you got to look it up. You got to, you know, he told me all the stuff I have to do. He said, then I would give you an A. And then he said, what are you going to do now? You know, you got good marks. You can go take whatever you want at this university, which it was Ryerson. And I just started to cry and said, I don't know. I've been praying for 30 days like you're supposed to. And he was just like, what is this woman talking about? He said, listen, go apply to the journalism school. And I said, oh my God, no, they're not going to let me in there. They're not going to. And he said, well, just do it as a favor to me. Go throw your name in the hat. And I got in. It still is really something to me. So I went to journalism school and I did really well. And then I got a job. And sobriety was amazing. And it was the 80s. You know, even mainstream AA wasn't like AA is today. There wasn't much dogma. People were like, yeah, you don't believe in God. That's fine. You know what? You can believe in this. You can do that. And we just talked a lot. There was no big book, yada, yada, yada. It wasn't like that. So anyway, I went to Africa for a year. Once I finished school, I went to Africa and I was freelancing. And I caught some illness. I don't know. I still don't know exactly what it was. So when I came back to Toronto, I was really sick and couldn't find work because I was too sick. And so I went back to Calgary to stay with my mom until I would get better. And she took me to a naturopath and he figured it out and I did start to get better. And then I started to get jobs. I got an offer at a newspaper. And up to this time, I had blocked everything out that had happened to me in Calgary. I didn't remember it. If you understand post-traumatic stress, you understand how that happens. But this one newspaper where I was working, I was getting hit on a lot. And I eventually got fired because I wouldn't sleep with this editor. And that was like a floodgate. It opened everything. All of a sudden, I'm 7 years sober and I'm suicidal because I'm having these flashbacks and I just like, what the hell? And so I went for therapy and I went to group therapy. And the idea was that I would go to Calgary for about 2 months and get better and then back to Toronto. But here I am in Calgary and just one thing after another is happening and I can't leave. And so then I met a guy and I got married. And I had 2 daughters. And AA in Calgary was never my favorite, anyways. But we see this trend towards right-wing fundamentalism in AA. And I'm going through trauma memories, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm getting more and more angry at the stuff I'm hearing, and whatever, whatever. So, around, about the 10-year mark, my meeting attendance started to wane, and by 12 years, I was like, I'm not going to these meetings anymore. I can't stand this. I'm gonna, my head, my head's gonna spin off my neck and huck itself at the wall. I've got to get out of here. Anyway, I ended up going through another really serious trauma. I was 14 years old, and I drank again. And I thought, if it doesn't work out, that's okay. I'll just go back to AA, not realizing, well, you hate AA, so that's probably not going to work. And you're older. I don't even know if I knew that. But the older you get, especially females, the harder it is to get someone. Anyways, so the trauma was my spouse, a very abusive man, and surprisingly so. He's a chairman at a university, and he can sure put on a good act. Anyway, so that started my. I mean, I never. I continued. I started going back to AA, and I never stopped. But I couldn't get sober, and I go in and out. And not in and out, I mean stopping going to meetings, just in and out drinking. And at first it was long periods, like I could get 6 months or 8 months and I'd go out. And I didn't know, and really, nor did a lot of people around me have any knowledge about the connection between PTSD and addiction. Anyways, I eventually found a psychologist who did understand that, and she helped me. She told me I had to leave Calgary. She said, "It's just too many traumas here. So every time you're walking around a corner, your nervous system gets fired, and most of the time you relapse and you can't even catch it." Now, all these years later, I can look back and see how she was right. I couldn't see it at the time, but I couldn't make that connection. So it was very hard. I was divorced at this point, but I had think I went to court 3 times to get the right to move. I couldn't believe it in the early 2000s that, I had to fight such a thing. with this seriously abusive partner. I need to leave and get the hell away from him. But anyway, I just knew deep down that that was a human right, and eventually it would work out, and it did. And I moved and I came back to Toronto. And I didn't get sober right away because I'm a journalist, and I was working these crazy overnight and day and morning shifts. And finally I realized, okay, that's part of the puzzle too. And I stopped doing that, and I took 3 months off work. And that was 2012. And I was 14 years in and out trying to get sober. That was it. Finally was able to stay sober. So I just celebrated 9 years on the 23rd of April, which is, yeah. And on April 22nd, I'm going to cry for sure. My little brother, who is also got PTSD and addiction. I've been trying to get that little fucker sober. Even when I wasn't sober, you know, this has been going on for years, and people would say to me, it's loving detachment, you know, you have to just leave him alone. And I'd be like, I'm not going to take advice from oppressed women in the 30s on this. You know what? I'm just going to leave that home. I'm going to keep trying to help my little brother. And my sister has finally gotten involved too. And we did an intervention, I don't know, beginning of April on Zoom with his wife. And he went into treatment on April 22nd. So, you know, that's my motto in this program. You just never give up. You just never give up. And I don't know if this will be it for him, but, you know, he's been saying to me for years, leave me alone, you're an AA bully, shit like that. But before he went into treatment, he said, you were bang on. You were bang on. And, so, yeah, that's one of the, I guess we're on to what it's like now. And that's one of the things that's just, I'm so grateful for lately. What is it like today? Well, I don't really want to be a journalist anymore. And it's not because I don't want to be a writer. It's because it's such an abusive industry. And I've actually taken my employer to the Human Rights Commission. And I'm still waiting on that. We were supposed to go to mediation last month. They continue to bully me and whatever, or attempt to bully me. What happened was they took away my seniority because of when I went off for treatment for addiction. So I went off in 2012. I'd been with the court for, I don't know, 25 years. And I said, well, but you took that break. It's just a weird way they backdate these things in the modern world, death of unions and everything. But in my case, they said, we're going to take your seniority because you took that time off. And I said, well, you know, you can't do that because I took that time off to go for treatment for alcoholism. And they were like, yeah, we don't care. And I went to the union and they're like, yeah, we don't care. And I just, you know, I went in circles with these people, continuing to tell them parts of my story. This is in 2017. And they just kept saying, yeah, we don't care. And I traumatized myself by trying to get them to listen to me. And anyways, I went off work because one of the final emails I got from them by that point, where they said they're not going to do anything, I was so traumatized, I thought I might drink. And so I called the treatment center where I had gone in 2012, and the therapist got on the phone and said, all right, you gotta go off work. And I did, and I didn't drink. I stayed sober, and I took them to the Human Rights Commission, and it's still ongoing, but it to me, I don't like, here's the interesting thing. The deadline for mediation this time was April 22nd. So on the day that I took my last drink, they're saying, no, we're not going to mediate. And I don't know, it's just the fact that it happened on the 22nd. I was like, you fuckers are so stupid. I'm going to win. I mean, there's just no way around this. You can't do that. You think you can bully me and scare me by playing these games? And I know I'm going to win. I just don't know how long it will take. And I think given everything that I've been given in AA and that I can come to a meeting at any time and have hundreds of people, I just feel like I owe it to AA to stand up for myself and for other addicts and say, you cannot take away, you cannot punish us, and you cannot stigmatize us anymore. And I, you know, if you met the 18-year-old young woman that showed up at AA, broken in every way, unable to, you know, walk, and I used to walk with my head down like this, terrified. And I'm not, you know, it's not like I'm not scared of what I'm doing, but I'm doing it and I don't walk with my head down and I won't give up. And I'm even thinking about writing about it, maybe, but it scares me. But, to me, that's a massive transformation. I just moved to a little place outside Toronto. My higher power, since I got sober the second time, has been my spirit animal, the wolf. And every day I become more and more connected with nature. And I'm taking a degree in counseling psychology, and I want to somehow combine the two. I'm a behavioral therapist for dogs as well. I want to combine them all. I don't really know anything about my spirituality. It sort of happens in front of me. And then I go, oh, that's spiritual. It all is very much like Indigenous beliefs, but they're not. I'm just sort of adapting them as I go along, as they present themselves to me. And I feel when I was working with dogs a few years ago, I got Lyme disease. So I'm often very sick because I'm doing aggressive treatment for it. But because I have Lyme disease, I'm even closer and closer to nature because I take mostly natural herbs and stuff. So I'm learning even more about nature, and I'm just starting to see. I highly recommend it to anybody and everybody. I watched this documentary on Apple TV recently called The Year the Earth Changed, and it's a crew went and followed animals all over the world over the last year as we went into our homes, what happened to the animals. And in the whales are jumping for joy and their babies are living, and the cheetahs, their little babies can hear their call, so they're not dying. And it was just like, oh my God. And, you know, so I'm so happy to be out of the big city. And I sit here in my new place, and I never thought I'd be like this, but it's so quiet, and I just listen. I just feel pure joy from how quiet it is. Well, I hope that was a good story. Thanks very much.